Welcome to the New Storm News Service. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. Today, our guest is Professor Doreen Stabinski, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at California State University, Sacramento. Professor Stabinski, we are, of course, now moving into a time when multinational corporations are patenting everything, and certainly with agreements like GATT and NAFTA, and now the multilateral agreement on investments, we're now getting to a place where governments, and in particular the United States government, is allowing multinational corporations to patent the genetic material of plants and animals, perhaps humans. I mean, being able to patent life itself.
In the U.S., we'd never allowed patenting on life forms. When Congress had debated it in the past, Congress had said, this is absurd. Humans don't create life. Life exists above and beyond humans. But at the insistence of the transnational corporations, they can now patent life forms. That is, have monopoly control over an entire lineage, an entire species of an organism. And to give you a sense of what this means, you know, we can own a dog, we can own a cat, but a patent on a species means that somebody would then own all chihuahuas that would ever exist, right? Your chihuahua has baby chihuahuas. If someone had a patent on that chihuahua, you'd have to pay royalties to the person who had the patent for each of those little babies. So the transnational corporations will use this by patenting seeds to then obviously exert monopoly control over the food supply. Genetically engineering soybeans means that if there's genetically engineered soybeans in the food supply, they can then charge higher prices because they've got the monopoly control over all of those soybeans that are out there.
And what we then have, of course, is that because they own soybeans, that's it. The soybeans are theirs from beginning to end. They're their soybeans, as it would be their chihuahuas, because they have manipulated the genetic code of whether it be this plant or this animal. And so because they have manipulated that genetic code, they then say, well, this is not the same chihuahua that used to run around. This is our new and improved chihuahua that we own, or soybeans or corn or whatever.
Sure, because what you're seeing in the agricultural supply industry is this consolidation. So the transnational corporations, and these are primarily agrochemical corporations, those corporations that used to sell us pesticides, have gone out and bought up all of the seed companies. So at some point in the future, you know, these now transnational biotechnology companies are going to be the only ones producing seed, and therefore the only seeds out there are going to be genetically engineered, and because of patent regimes, they'll all be patented.
Who are the companies that are going about doing this, Professor Stabinski? I mean, I think I know, like, Monsanto is one of the big ones. Are there others that we should know about?
Monsanto is the big one in the U.S. There was recently a merger between Ciba Geigy and Sandoz into a company called Novartis, now the largest agrochemical and pharmaceutical corporation on the planet. Recently, a consolidation between Hoechst and Schering in Germany into a company called Agrivo. So what we're seeing is larger and larger companies and fewer of them actually in control. Dow Chemical, you know, if you name off the agrochemical corporations, the major chemical corporations that you know of, they're probably either in the list of companies in control of this technology, or they've been bought up by a company in control of the technology.
Talk, if you will, about the technology, because as we were talking before we went on mic, I'm somewhat, I think, knowledgeable about the economic and political aspects of globalization and where that's going. But the technological aspect of it is something that I don't really understand, and I understand a little bit. But talk about those aspects of how this is happening and how they're going about doing this.
The technology isn't that difficult to understand if you know that when you know, when we have kids, we pass on our traits, our genes, our heritable characteristics to our kids. And what scientists have figured out is how to isolate information that codes for particular traits. Now, you know that, you know, your kids are different from you, and that not all of how a human being develops is based on inheritance, right? A lot of it is based on environment. But to the extent that we can isolate things that are heritable, eye color or whatever, or in the case of plants that are being genetically engineered, genes, particular pieces of information to be resistant to an herbicide, those can be transferred from one organism to another. And then that new organism can have a trait that it never had before. And the traits can be transferred not just between plants, but from bacteria to plants, from plants to animals, from humans to animals, from bacteria to plants. You know, all of the kingdoms can be mixed and matched at this point. And, of course, even we could genetically engineer human beings with genes from other species. That's not being talked about right now. But we are talking about genetically engineering human beings.
We're talking with Professor Doreen Stabinski, who is the Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at California State University in Sacramento. And we're talking about cloning and the genetic engineering of life and how that translates into what is happening throughout the world, where huge multinational corporations are now attempting to claim ownership of life itself, whether it be plant life or animal life or whatever life they decide to try and create. Professor Stabinski, let me ask you this. I mean, when people are refraining from discussing the cloning of human beings, and it would seem to me if you can clone a sheep, you probably can clone a human being. Don't we run into the possibility of where some corporation starts thinking about, well, gee, let's genetically engineer really short, squat people so they can be miners or whatever? I mean, do you see where I'm going with this? It would seem to me that, I mean, anybody who knows that these corporations will do almost anything for profit, I know somebody in some R&D facility somewhere has to been thinking about, you know, how can we make some bucks by creating specialized human beings. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the technology of cloning humans and the sensitivity of people to that issue will keep that from happening for a long time. The technology really doesn't exist. With the sheep, it took 277 tries to get one sheep that was alive. I don't think people would be willing to see that happen to 277 fetuses, right, to try to get one right. You know, you'd have to have a lot of birth mothers around to get one right. So the technology's not really there for humans. But what we do know about, we have cases right now, instances of use of genetic information about people. And the fear is that this genetic information that we have about people will be used to either pigeonhole them into particular jobs. We know that they're susceptible to particular kinds of cancer, or they're not, right? So that they would fit into a particular type of work environment. That information has been used to discriminate against people in terms of employment, discriminate against them in terms of access to insurance, and that information and the privacy of genetic information is a topic that people are discussing, and it's a topic that even the ACLU has taken up at this point.
I heard a story, and I don't know if this is something you would be prepared to talk about, but something called the Human Genome Project. Are you familiar with that? Because basically, as I understand it, at least part of this Human Genome Project is that people are going and collecting DNA samples from indigenous Indian tribes. And whether they're collecting it from other people, I don't know. But I have heard that they're going in and I'm going to say probably primarily in South America, though probably other places as well, where they are trading these indigenous people. They're trading them medicine and food and things like that in exchange for their genetic material. I mean, is this something that you're familiar with?
Yeah, I am familiar with. It's not the Human Genome Project, though, which
I'm
is
sorry.
A project. That's a national project. Actually, it's a project that spans with the U.S. and Europe, developed countries, to just basically sequence, to find out all the information that's in the human genome, all of human genes. And as I said before, you know, we know that genes aren't everything, and the Human Genome Project would like to reduce us, human beings, to solely the information that that's contained in our cells, and there's a lot of scientific falsehood associated with that. The Human Genome Diversity Project is something different. It's an attempt by scientists and anthropologists to go out and catalog the diversity of human beings around the world. If we know that products that transnationals are going to be developing based on these genetic information, we know that those products are going to bring in lots of money for transnational corporations, and those products are going to be based on genetic diversity, then the most genetic diversity that we can find, if we can go out and catalog and get all those genes, somewhere there's going to be genes out there that are going to profit people. The Human Genome Diversity Project, the ostensible reason is for the project is to go out and find out what diversity is out there. And, you know, if these indigenous peoples are going to go extinct, then at least we'll have samples of their DNA for posterity, even if we don't have them there for posterity. But unfortunate things that have been associated with enterprises like that have been the patenting of cell lines. So researchers going out, getting genetic material or biological material, finding that it has some biological interest and some potentially profitable interest as well, and patenting it so that people from Panama have been patented, people from Papua New Guinea, people from the Solomon Islands, all patented in the U.S. by the U.S. Department of Commerce.
Talk, if you will, a little bit more about that, because, well, let me do this first. Let me let the listeners know that we're talking with Professor Doreen Stabinski, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at California State University, Sacramento. My name is Mike Thornton. This is from the New Storm News Service. You are listening to community-supported radio, KVMR-FM, Nevada City, Auburn, Sacramento. You got me, Professor Stabinski. Individuals from these areas of the world have already been patented. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I slightly misspoke, because what has been done is they've had their biological material taken and cells from those individuals immortalized, what we call immortalized, that is put on a petri dish and made so that those cells live forever. So in fact, and it's those cell lines that have been patented. In fact, it really is the genetic information of that individual that's been patented. That particular individual hasn't been patented, but for all intents and purposes, you know, what scientists think that individual is, that is their DNA, is patented and is, or has, they've attempted to patent it and stick it in a laboratory somewhere. Now, there's been international, you know, huge international outcry against this, and I believe that all of the patents that were filed and granted in the U.S. have been revoked, that they have withdrawn the patents.
So the point being is that whatever these corporations were who did this, I mean, do you know the corporations that did this?
Oh, it's the National Institutes of Health. It's not corporations.
It's government.
It's been government agencies
that
have
done this.
Yeah, the patents have been granted to the U.S. Department of Commerce, which would be the agency that files for a patent on behalf of somebody like the National Institutes of Health.
So what we have then is we have the United States government attempting and having done so, in essence, patenting human beings, and then revoking the patents when an international outcry, when it was discovered that they had done this, that, oh, no, we changed our minds now. I mean, that's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah. And in fact, this practice has been given a term, biopiracy, that is going out and taking the genes from other people, taking biological material from, you know, indigenous peoples and other subsistence cultures around the planet, because they're isolated, they have a great amount of diversity, they also have cultural diversity, and probably they have other biological resources that are not themselves, but plants and animals that they use for different purposes. All of that information has been taken up to the north, to the developed world, patented in one form or another, and will in the you know, next century be used to generate profits for the transnational corporations involved in this research.
We're talking with Professor Doreen Stabinski, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at Sac State College. Wow. I've got to admit it, I've heard a lot of things over doing this show over the last several years here, and to find out that despite all of the somewhat lofty rhetoric of respect for human life that I hear in the media and from the government and so forth and so on, is that in fact our own government has attempted to patent human beings, and only revoking those patents when an international outcry demands that they back off of that. See, I guess that's the thing which makes me nervous about accepting this whole issue of whether or not experiments with cloning human beings are happening. I mean, yes, people will be real upset if they know. But as long as they don't know, who knows what they're doing? I mean, they're patenting people, and no one really knew. And then when people knew, they said, oh, we're not going to do that anymore.
Right, right. I mean, most people don't know anything about genetic engineering, is my sense, you know, from talking to school students. They haven't really been introduced to the concept. They've heard maybe a little bit about the flavor saver tomato or bovine somatotropin, some of the first products of genetically engineered food. But it's, you know, genetically engineered food in our food supply now is primarily soybeans, which are just in everything, and there's not really any way you can know about genetically engineered food because the FDA has decided that it's not important to label that, that consumers don't want to know, they don't care, and so why should we label that food?
And what happens, of course, I think, as you so stated, and my wife, who is a gardener, and she was telling me about the fact that these seeds are now being replaced by these sort of hybrid seeds. And that is, in essence, what you were talking about earlier, is that traditional crops and traditional plants are being pushed out of existence. And what we have now is this whole new burgeoning crop of various types of hybrids, which are able to be patented because they're not traditional indigenous plants. And so therefore all of that's being moved out primarily without the knowledge of the people of the United States and other countries around the world, right?
Right, right. Without the knowledge of people in the U.S. And, of course, the U.S. in the European Union, in Europe, people are much more aware. There's been a much greater campaign for awareness, and people have a much greater sensitivity to food, sensibility about food in Europe. So they care a lot more, and they have been clamoring for labeling of genetically engineered food. And up until this point, there is legislation at the level of the European Union in place that would allow labeling. Now, the U.S., well, the food transnationals that are growing genetically engineered food know that that would be the death knell to actually label those products. So they have been exerting pressure on our Secretary of Agriculture, who has been exerting through, you know, our various trading relationships with Europe, a lot of pressure on Europe to not label genetically engineered food.
Caller, you're live on the air on KVMR.
Hi, I would like to ask your guest if she can speak to vaccines being genetically engineered into our food.
I don't know a lot about the engineering of vaccines into food. I do know that they're attempting to genetically engineer bananas, et cetera, so that they might deliver a vaccine. It would be an easy way to deliver to children, you know, their infant, their childhood vaccines.
It's not you. You're fine. I was just talking to all those people out in the hall. Please, go ahead.
I just wonder if the caller has any more specific information that she wanted about vaccines.
She's no longer on the line with us, but perhaps she'll call back, and maybe this is her now. Caller, you're live on the air.
Yes, I'm calling back.
Well, thank you.
I understand that it's in La Jolla, something to do with Scripps, and they're working with potatoes, bananas, broccoli, and some other vegetables. And there's a lot of people who object to the use of vaccines and the dangers of vaccines, and that's really going to take control out of parents and people's hands if it's in food. And how on earth could it be used in food? I mean, you're going to eat potatoes once every 6 months or every 6 years, or what insanity is this?
Yeah, you know, and I'm sorry, but I wish that I had more information for you. That is one area of genetically engineered food that I'm not as up on as I should be in order to answer your question.
I'm sure there's a lot to be up on.
Caller, let me ask you a question just for my own clarification. What I'm hearing you say is that there is a move or attempts happening now to inundate food products with various types of vaccines to get around the resistance of parents to have their children vaccinated. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, that's what it appears to me to possibly be. They're going to tell you it's going to be ease of administration and all of that, but there's a stronger and stronger movement. There are so many vaccines in the pipeline, you can't even imagine it. And they've even talked about it having, ones that you inhale or sprays into the nose, and they could put that in a subway. We've heard that story before. Mm-hmm. And if it can be in food, and you can't control every piece of food that your child eats, it's horrifying to me. The genetic engineering of food, period, is horrifying, but to play with Mother Nature this way is just obscene.
Right. Well, the interesting thing is that the biotechnology industry comes up with these cases where they can sell the industry. They can say, well, isn't genetic engineering wonderful? We could put vaccines into bananas and it would make it so easy for children to get their vaccines, etc. It's the same with solving world hunger. That's another reason why we should have biotechnology, because all of a sudden hungry people will be able to eat more food, even if they still don't have any more money.
Well, the bottom line is, this is the way we can make money. So, anyway.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you for calling in this evening. You're tuned to Community Supported Radio, KVMR FM, Nevada City, Auburn, Sacramento. My name is Mike Thornton. This is the News Storm News Service. Our guest this evening is Professor Doreen Stabinski, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at California State University, Sacramento. And our topics are genetic engineering of food and cloning, and I'm learning a lot of stuff. I'm still blown away by the fact that our government has actually taken the cells and DNA of living individuals and patented them, or tried to patent them, until an international outcry forced them to revoke those patents, though I guess they still probably have the material, would be my guess.
Yeah, I'm sure that they still have the material. The patenting, the patenting of genes is not at all unusual at this point. So, for instance, you might have heard of the researchers that have discovered the breast cancer genes. Now, there's a lot of problems with calling them the breast cancer genes, because in fact they only are associated with breast cancer in a very small portion of women who will get breast cancer, and they are only genes that might indicate a tendency to get breast cancer in a small minority of women, so that maybe 5% of the women who will ultimately get breast cancer would even have these genes. It's a particular type of breast cancer that they get. The corporation, though, owns the patent on the genes. The corporation, by owning the patent on the genes, can then make an awful lot of money by selling diagnostic tests. And so, by being able to patent a gene, a piece of genetic information that lots and lots of people might have, the corporation's not the only one that has a gene. The gene's in, all these people walking around on the planet, but the corporation is the only entity that actually owns the gene. Well, that's absurd in and of itself, but all of these different diagnostic tests then, all different kinds of diseases that are related to heritable conditions, then, some corporation is able to make money by patenting our genetic information.
And what this is, of course, is part of a much larger move, which is, of course, the economic globalization that is going on around the planet. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And I think your headphones might be causing a little feedback in the mic.
Well, sure. What we see around the planet is a consolidation of power in the hands of fewer and fewer transnational corporations, as those corporations then consolidate their power worldwide. Although in the biotechnology industry, the players, Monsanto still very much is a U.S. corporation based in the U.S., but if you notice what they do in order to conduct their research year-round, they're taking their genetically engineered organisms to the far corners of the planet and releasing them into environments in the far corners of the planet in order to create seeds to make more seeds year-round, rather than having to deal with our seasonal patterns.
As I understand it, there, of course, is a growing resistance to this corporatization of the world, and in particular the issue of genetically engineered crops. I believe I read a story that in Ireland, a group of people, I can't remember the name of the group, but they attacked and destroyed an experimental Monsanto factory. You're smiling. You've heard of this, correct?
Yeah, I don't know the name of the group. I know there is a legal challenge by a group called Genetic Concern in the courts, and it wasn't Genetic Concern, but they actually went into the field and destroyed a Monsanto experiment, pulled up a crop of sugar beets. The sugar beets were genetically engineered, I believe, to be resistant to a particular herbicide. So you see another one of their strategies, and this is the strategy of the biotechnology / chemical industry, because what they're doing is creating genetically engineered crops that are tolerant to the herbicides that they produce, so that then when they sell the seed to the farmer, they can also sell the herbicide to the farmer. It's a package deal, and it perpetuates the farmer's purchasing of their herbicide, even if the herbicide eventually goes off patent.
So we have a symbiotic relationship where the corporation owns the plant and then also owns all of the chemicals necessary to make the plant grow.
Right, and well,
I guess then that leads me to this. Well, it leads me to something that I wanted to ask you. When I asked you about them destroying the crop at Monsanto, I saw you smile. Do you think this is a good idea?
Do I think what is a good idea? Pulling up the sugar beets?
Pulling up the sugar beets, yes.
Sure, of course I think it's a good idea. I think it's a good thing to let these corporations know that people are not very happy about the technology. And in Europe, as I said earlier, there's been a lot more resistance to genetically engineered food and genetically engineered plants in general than there has been in the U.S. I think there's a very different amount of information that we get from our media than in Europe, and so it's much harder for us to be informed. And we have a government that doesn't want us to be informed, that has decided that we should not know whether our food is genetically engineered or not, so that whenever somebody can get in the news, and this is, I mean, it's not only a form of resistance, but it's a form of getting in the media and letting corporations know and letting the government know that there's a lot of resistance out there to this technology.
Talk about the legal challenge that you had mentioned earlier.
I think it's a pretty straightforward legal challenge. My sense is, I have the brief and I haven't read it recently, but I believe it is that they just hadn't filed the proper environmental impact statements in order to carry out this test. And in fact, people have been challenging these herbicide-tolerant plants on a number of grounds, because it's not just, we're not just talking about the plants causing a problem, causing an ecological problem, but the increase in use of herbicides that we know would come along with this, and that to evaluate the ecological risks of the plant, you in fact have to evaluate right alongside it the ecological risks of that increased herbicide use.
It seems to me, and perhaps it's, you know, my naivete about some of this subject, but I mean, does anybody really know the ecological and environmental impact? I mean, we're moving into a whole new millennium here of scientific endeavor. I mean, we are now playing around with the very building blocks of life. I mean, does anybody really know where that's going to lead? I mean, you change it today, and then it begins evolving on its own. I mean,
right,
in a different path that it, I mean, it seems that's the logical progression to me. Perhaps not. What do you think about that?
Well, ecological science is not at the point where we have a really great amount of predictive ability. So, no. I mean, we can't even predict the consequences of taking, you know, a plant from one continent and introducing it into an ecosystem in another continent. We don't know if that naturally occurring plant on one continent is going to be a weed on another continent, let alone a genetically engineered plant, which mixes and matches information from, you know, all kinds of kingdoms. There's been one study that was published very recently about a plant that was genetically engineered to be insect tolerant. That is, it was genetically engineered to kill aphids. Well, what the researchers found out was that the ladybugs that fed on the aphids had a much shorter life cycle, and that their fertility was reduced, so that you've not only killed the aphids, but you've killed off a beneficial insect, their natural biological control and what kinds of ramifications that has further up the food chain, the organisms that eat the ladybugs, etc., you don't know. Those impacts could look very small at the field level and actually be very big in terms of the ecosystem level.
And of course, though, up the food chain eventually gets up the food chain to human beings. And,
sure.
And then we have absolutely no idea what the long-term effects of consuming these genetically engineered foods could and may be. Right?
Sure. When we have a huge amount of our food supply coming from genetically engineered foods, which the FDA isn't allowing us to learn about how much of our food really is genetically engineered, we could see consequences from that.
We're talking with Professor Doreen Stubinsky, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at California State University, Sacramento. My name is Mike Thornton, and this is the New Storm News Service. You're tuned to community-supported radio, KVMR-FM, Nevada City, Auburn, Sacramento. Professor Stubinsky, I'd like to take you back to something that you had touched on earlier, and this is the genetic engineering using multiple species. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, where they start cross engineering species to species, because that strikes me as something that could be really dangerous.
Well, I think what I was referring to, maybe it's not the same thing as you're referring to, but the fact that you can take a gene from a moth and put it into a potato. You can take a gene from a bacterium and put it into a tomato. You can take a gene from a human and put it into a pig. You know, so that, and the scientific thought behind all of that is, well, if we know what the gene does, if we know what it's supposed to do in the bacterium, then obviously it's going to do the same thing in the plant. Well, that's not the case. And in fact, we learned that very clearly when we took a human growth hormone gene and put it in a pig. And what we found were pigs that were arthritic, they had kidney problems, they had severe physiological disorders, and were not very happy pigs. And so the scientific reasoning just falls flat when you try and make those extrapolations.
And we have, I mean, there's something about scientists that remind me of kids with new toys. You give them a new toy, and it's like, let's play with it. And especially if they think they're going to be able to play with it and come up with something that's going to make them money.
Right.
You know, and so why do you put a human growth gene in a pig in the first place? I mean, what's the rationale for that? Just to see what'll happen, right?
Sure, to see what will happen. And of course, they can rationalize it by saying that, well, once we get the technology perfected, I don't think it was with a human growth hormone gene. It may have been with a cow growth hormone gene that they actually, increasing the expression of a pig gene, its own gene, or injecting it with its own gene product, but where you could make pigs that were leaner, right? So, you know, once they've created these things, then they come up with a rationalization afterwards, right? Well, of course it's good because now the pigs are leaner, and that's really what we wanted to do in the first place anyway. But really, I mean, it's true. They're just, you know, they're doing things because they can. And, you know, you can see that very clearly with the first products that came out in genetically engineered plants. The first genes that they had access to were these herbicide resistance genes. They were the easiest ones to find. And, you know, wasn't it great that they could also figure out a product to go with it? But it wasn't because creating herbicide-resistant plants were these big pressing problems in agriculture that we really needed to use the newest technology to solve. No, I mean, it's a technology in search of a product. It's a technology in search of a problem. It's not being directed at the major problems that we face in society or in agriculture or whatever.
Well, it reminds me when you're speaking, I'm thinking a lot about the way the pharmaceutical industry approaches developing medications. Those medications which will make a lot of money, are a lot of R&D money is put into them. And of course, you know, these few people over here who may be suffering from some horrible illness that could be at least partially, if not totally, alleviated are forgotten about because there's not enough money to be made in researching that type of medication or creating that type of medication. And that's really the same thing you're saying about this genetic engineering.
Right? Sure, sure. And in fact, a friend of mine, when human growth hormone first came out, it was, the gene was isolated and the pharmaceutical companies realized that they could make a product that you could administer to people. And of course they said that, well, this is great. It's a cure for dwarfism, hereditary dwarfism. But in fact, what my friend said and what has come, it's come to be shown to be true, is that, well, there's not enough dwarves out there for this to be economically viable. And in fact, the pharmaceutical industries have targeted the lowest 3%, the shortest 3% of the population. It's not being targeted at. It's not being directed towards those people with hereditary dwarfism. It's being directed towards just normally short people. And of course, there will always be the shortest 3% of the population to be administering this hormone to.
And it becomes more of, it's kind of like genetic plastic surgery, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be taller, here, we have this for you.
Sure, sure. Or for parents who want their kids to be basketball stars. It's a product for them as well.
Right, and that, yeah. See, this is where it always goes. It always goes there. We're talking with Professor Doreen Stavinsky, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies, California State University, Sacramento. Professor Stavinsky, let me ask you this as well. On several occasions this evening, you've talked about the FDA not really wanting the American public to know how much of their food is genetically altered. In your opinion, how much of our food is genetically altered? I mean, what is your best guesstimate or estimate on this?
At this point, not much. Right now, the products that we're looking at are, well, milk products have the potential to be manufactured with the cows producing milk using bovine growth hormone. So the cows are injected with bovine growth hormone. That's a genetically engineered product. Right now in the food supply, we also have genetically engineered soy and we have genetically engineered corn, which means that not a large proportion of the food, the total food that we eat, the total weight of food that we eat, but probably if we're eating packaged food that has any kind of soy product in it, lecithin, soy oil, any of that kind of stuff, probably has genetically engineered soy in it.
And this genetically, and I'm thinking now about genetically engineered corn, and we only have a couple of minutes left, and I really want to get to one more thing before we leave after this. I mean, this genetically engineered corn, of course, is what allows for these, tremendous amounts of corn to be produced, which has now, of course, pushed the corn farmers of Chiapas out of business and basically replaced their corn with this sort of no-nutrition, empty corn product stuff.
Right.
Professor Stavinsky, if you could, I would like to ask you to leave the listeners with one parting thought about the topics that we discussed tonight, and also to invite you to come back on the program in the future. I would very much like to have you on the show again. But what do you think is the most important thing for the listeners to get out of this tonight?
Well, I think the most important thing for me is for people to reconnect with the food supply, to understand where their food is coming from, and to make informed choices in the marketplace, to ask the FDA to allow their food to be labeled if they really worry about the fact that all of agriculture is now moving in the direction of genetically engineered food.
Professor Doreen Stavinsky, thank you for being with us on the program.